Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome to Hollywood and Levine. I am Ken Levine, your podcast host. This is episode 247. This is also part two of my interview with showrunner, writer, creator Dave Hackle. And this week we talk a lot about Becker. He is the creator of Becker, and he'll talk a lot about the job of showrunning. And it is a very specialized and very difficult one. You will find out all about that. If you missed part one, after you listen to this, go back and check that out. So part two with Dave Hackle this week on Hollywood and Levine. All right, I want to get into Becker. You worked on Frasier for a couple of years, and let's see if I remember this correctly in my old age. You had written a pilot that was about telemarketers or something.
Yeah.
And I remember there was like one character in particular who was this acerbic guy, and I remember David, my partner David Isaacs, and I saying, "That guy, we love that guy. Should do something with that guy." Am I remembering that correctly? And from there, you turned him into Becker.
Absolutely correctly. Yeah, I wrote a spec pilot about people that everybody hates. The people who call you on the phone to bother you. Mm-hmm. Didn't occur to me that was a bad idea. But the guy who worked there was, as you described it, he was a very Beckerish kind of guy. And not only did you guys identify that, but I believe it was Gary Hart at Paramount who said, you know, we don't really like the pilot, but we love this guy. What could you do with him? And I was thrilled because I love that guy, too. And so I redid it and wrote the Becker pilot. He was a doctor mainly to offset what a prick he could be.
Right. Take the curse off him a little bit.
Yeah. So, you know, I wrote that. Paramount was happy with it. I was happy with it. You and David were happy with it. So that meant a lot. And so what to do with it now? I figured that, and Paramount agreed, we have to get a piece of talent to go sell this, because the character, if you could identify a piece of talent to go with it, it would be easier sell than say, we have to find this guy to play this part, because it was not your feel good, normal kind of sitcom character. So I sent it to a lot of agents and managers with a letter saying what I wanted to do, and please look over their client lists and whatnot. So one of the people I sent it to was Ted Danson's manager. He manages a lot of people, Keith Addis. And when someone at Paramount mentioned, I think it was Dan Fauci, who was a friend of Ted's, said, "What about Ted Danson?" And I'll be honest with you, and I've told Ted this, I thought, Ted Danson, he's a great actor, but is he the guy you go to for a sarcastic son of a bitch?
We thought the same thing. Yeah.
So the script went out. I don't know who all got it, but one day my secretary said, Ted Danson's on the phone for you. Well, I'd never gotten a call from Ted Danson. So I took the call, and he said, I read your script. I really liked it. I know you probably don't think I'm right for it. And I don't know if I don't think I am either, but would you be willing to sit down and just talk to me about it? Of course. When would you like to talk? So I ended up going over to Ted's house on that following weekend. And we sat in his living room and talked for at least 4 hours, maybe more. And at the end of that 4 hours, it was really clear that we both saw what the show could be. We agreed on that. We liked each other. We had a really good afternoon together. And we needed, what's the next plan? So the next plan was, we decided, let's have a reading of the show. Let's get people around a table, actors, call in our friends, get an audience. You were there. David was there. Some executives from Paramount were there. Ted had his friends there. And the deal we made was that if either Ted or I didn't like the way it felt, with Ted being the main character, we could walk away. No harm, no foul. If Ted said, I don't want to do this, that's fine. If I didn't want to do it with him, that was fine with him. And the reading went exceptionally well. And I just remember leaning back in my chair. There was one person between Ted and I. And we leaned back and looked at each other. And Ted said, I'm in if you are. And I was. And that's how it began. So, the key to that was, have an idea you love and pray that you get Ted Danson to want to do it. because even with that, you still got to get lucky. Ted had a deal with CBS. They were looking for a show that Ted wanted to do. And he had this script, and they liked the script. And how those stars came together, I have no idea. But you had to get really lucky for that to happen.
Yeah. I also remember you and I and David, about a year or two before, wrote a pilot together that we thought Ted would be good for. And we met with Ted. Remember, we met with him at the Grill in the Alley. Excuse me. And Ted passed on it because the character was very similar to Sam Malone. And he said, I don't want to just keep doing versions of Sam Malone. And, he proved that he was very versatile. I had worked with him for 9 years before you got a chance to work with him. You were his showrunner. Talk a little bit about Ted Danson and what an absolute joy it is to have Ted Danson as your actor.
Well, you just said it. It's a joy. He's the best. We're most always on the same page. I respected his opinion. He respected mine. But he didn't want a producer credit, but I believe he often functioned as a producer on stage because he had so much experience doing four-camera shows. He just knew what worked and what was needed and what worked for him and how you got such great feedback from him that was so educated in the form. And he set a great example for everyone else, how to behave, how to disagree politely, how to encourage. He's just the best. And the best takeaway from it after all these years is we're still friends. It was just, you just knew that if Ted couldn't make it work, it didn't work.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
And you trusted that. And you'd never go back to the room and say, well, how do we change this just a little bit to make him feel? No, you don't want to make him do anything. You want him to love it. And so you wanted to work your ass off to make Ted Danson happy, because in return, you got that performance.
And you got appreciation.
Yeah.
You got appreciation from Ted. And
I directed 14 of them, and I noticed Ted would be very good during the week with rehearsal, and he knew where the jokes were, and he was, like I said, very good. But when the red light went on and the cameras were rolling,
yeah,
he just stepped it up like 10%, and I can't even quantify exactly what he did, maybe a little more reactions or a little subtler reactions or how he delivered the line, but there was just something about his performance that just came up even more, yeah, when the cameras were rolling. He was just such an amazing professional.
Yeah, I can't imagine having a better experience with an actor. And you knew him, like you said, you knew him for those years on Cheers, so you knew what to expect down there. But I had never had such a lovely experience.
And yes, boils you, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. It does. Well, you notice I haven't rushed to do another one since I wasn't going to get that lucky twice.
And the odd thing is, everywhere that CBS put that show, it did well. It got
did okay.
good ratings.
Yeah.
And they just kept moving it around. You know, networks will fall in love with certain shows, and other shows they just, you know, tolerate, I guess. I don't know. But, and recently, you look at Modern Family and The Middle. And right. Modern Family got all the ABC love, and The Middle got nothing. And I think what that does is it seeps into the perception of viewers and certainly TV Academy members that it's like, well, this is not a hot show. And as a result, I don't think you get the appreciation. You don't get the Emmy nominations. You really should. And CBS, like I said, you got moved how many times?
Boy.
Like 5, 6, you never knew when the show was on.
I never knew. The thing about it was, I mean, there were a lot of things that were nice about working at CBS. They left you alone. They gave you very few notes. They weren't trying to micromanage the show. But then again, they weren't promoting the show. There was a time there where I thought I should just change the name of the show to Ann Becker, because that's all I ever heard. It was, you know, this King of Queens, Everybody Loves Raymond, Ann Becker. And we would have terrific guest stars and do an interesting show. And you thought, well, I'm sure they'll promote this because we have Dick Van Dyke, or we have Hal Holbrook, or, you know, George Wendt, or Rhea Perlman. You know, the Cheers gang was mini reunion. Ann Becker. And I never understood. I never understood.
You know, and just to underscore what you said, take a look at some of these guest stars. As you said, Dick Van Dyke, Avery Schreiber, Gilbert Gottfried, Brenda Vaccaro, Jacqueline Smith, Richard Schiff, John Slattery, Kim Darby, Stephen Wright, John Astin, LeVar Burton, Leonard Nimoy, Hal Holbrook, as you mentioned, George and Rhea, John Cryer, Mary Steenburgen.
Mary did a little bit at the end for us. Kelsey was on the show.
Yeah. And you.
And yeah. we had John Mahoney came and did a guest shot for us. And I thought, well, Frasier's the number one show. They'll certainly promote that. Ann Becker. I didn't understand. I think you have to make good friends with whoever does the promotion. That's the person I missed.
I also remember for our 100th episode, and when you have 100 episodes, that's really a milestone. I mean, that's when you cross the River Jordan and can go into syndication. It's a big deal. And David and I wrote the 100th episode, and I directed the 100th episode. And we're going to have a big party, because usually when there's the 100th episode of a show, there's, you know, a whole big celebration, and the network does a whole big rollout and everything else. And we were supposed to be on Sunday night. And we all met at a restaurant, and the NFL football game went over. So they decided to adjust the lineup, and they preempted us.
Yeah.
You know, it's like for our big 100th episode, you're preempted.
And Becker.
Yeah, and Becker. Okay. I want to get into show running now, because you were the showrunner of Becker, also of Wings. And I've worked with a lot of showrunners, and honestly, you are one of the best, certainly one of the most organized. And I thought you are a great guy to talk to about what that job is, because people don't realize it. They think, oh, okay, you're a showrunner. Great. You know, you're the boss. You just get to make all the decisions. And I've always maintained that, like, next to directing an epic sword and sandal movie, being a showrunner is the hardest job in show business.
I always wanted to do a sword and sandal sitcom, but I've never even heard that before.
Yeah, on stage. Yeah, do in front of the audience. Yeah. At the beginning of a season, would you go into a season with a calendar and try to work out, okay, I need to have so many stories broken by this date. I need to have so many scripts by this date. How would you go into a season?
A couple of things that you said is, or what I try to do. One is I try to begin each season with a rough idea of where I hope the show and the characters would be by the end of the season. In other words, was there an arc for the show? Was there an arc for a character? And you could write to that and sort of look at the season and go, by this time, let's hope that so-and-so has met someone, fallen in love, and then they can start to fall out of love and break up by the end, whatever mm-hmm. the arc was. So that was sort of in just really rough. But, you know, being organized, I don't know, that was certainly my goal. But if I was, I think, Ken, it was driven by fear.
Everything in Hollywood is driven by fear.
Yeah. Fear that I'd screw it up, fear that I'd let people down, fear that I wouldn't handle the budget right. I tried to control the things I could and then always expect the unexpected, which never failed to happen.
Yeah.
As you know, it doesn't matter how much preparedness you have. There always is a point on the calendar where you will be hopelessly behind. And I have no idea how that happens, but you can have all your shows broken before you do the first one, and you'll still find a place on the calendar where everything goes to shit. Because you never know what's going to happen. An actor gets sick and can't show up. The network decides to, you know, we're going to have double your fun on NBC. And that means we're going to show two episodes this week. And you go, no, don't do that, because I don't have one ready for next week. So all of a sudden, your plans went out the window. NBC did that to me once on Wings. Four Weddings and a Funeral was a big hit movie at the time. So in their brilliance, they decided to do sitcom week, four funerals and a wedding all in one night. So apparently one of their shows had a wedding story planned. So my job was to come up with a funeral show. Well, that wasn't in my plans. So whatever I was going to do the next week went out the window, and I had to come up with the show that had a funeral in it. All I tried to do was make the best use of pre-production and hiatus weeks. A lot of people saw those as times that we can all go to lunch, we can all go to the beach. It's not a problem. I just thought I would love to have 12 or 13 stories broken and everybody on the staff have a script in by the time we begin. That was always my goal.
Right. And like you said, I remember you were in the middle of production one week and 9/11 happens.
Yeah.
And like, okay, how does that affect? And like currently, you know, you look at all of the shows, they're multi-camera shows, and last year the pandemic hits. Okay,
absolutely.
How do you deal with that? yeah, it, you know, or the network wants you to fire an actor. So now all of the shows that he was in, you have to rewrite. Or like you said, an actor gets pleurisy. We had that on Cheers, where the coach, you know, Nick Colasanto, had pleurisy and was taken off the set by an ambulance. And he was in 80% of the show. Well, that was a long night. You got to come up with something else. Yeah.
Absolutely. We had that on Wings. The first year that I ran Wings by myself, we had had a great pre-production. I got, I think, 12 or 13 shows broken and written, and we were just sailing. And before the first one film, Tom Haydenchurch quit the show. And so all of the, you had to unthread him, not only from the stories that were about him, but you had to unthread him through all the other scripts. And so, you know, I was so proud. Well, this is going to be such an easy year. It was horrible. We, because all the shows that we had done had to be redone before we even started. So, you know, that happens. But, you know, you asked me once, you know, that people always said to you, well, what's your typical day working?
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? what I always told people was, once I used to come into the office a little early to have some time to do some work by myself. But once anybody knew you were there, and I'm sure this was the same for you and David, there's a line outside your door and you spend the rest of the day answering questions. Which actor, which word, which couch, which shot, which dress, which, you're just giving your opinions all day long. And in that typical day, you're answering all those questions, but you're also breaking new stories and going to casting and going to editing and going to writer's room and going to rehearsal. It's like getting on a hamster wheel in June and not getting off until April. Some days it's running like crazy. Other days, it's not always horrible. Sometimes it's a great week. It's smooth. It's easy. You're having fun. But it's a lot of work. The thing though that I always try to remember, it's not like you had to send Harry in first. We weren't in a coal mine. Even on my worst day, I laughed out loud because I'm with some of the funniest people in town. So on the horrible days, you laughed out loud.
Yeah. And it's tough sometimes because there is so much pressure and so much else going on that you have to step back and go, hey, we're doing a comedy show here.
Yeah.
And I know one of the things that I learned to do in terms of compartmentalizing was when you got your writers together and you were sitting in a room doing a rewrite, forget about everything else. Okay. Just work on the rewrite and focus on that and focus on having fun. And then I'll deal with the crushing pressure afterwards. But for these 3-4 hours, you know, concentrate on this. And it's tough, but, you know, so much of show running and even being a comedy writer is from experience and learning. I mean, you talked a lot about that line producer who exposed you to scoring and editing and casting and all of those areas that you need to have a background in order to do the job well.
Also, concentrating on the rewrite only is such great advice. And I wish you'd given it to me a number of years ago. but it also helped every once in a while to remember, at least for me, I got to remember, you're doing what you always wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
Someone's allowing you to do this. I mean, it's fantastic. And I never thought it was going to, you know, there were years there where I didn't know if that was going to happen. So, learning to be grateful about it. And also, you know, we were lucky. You worked at 20th for a long time. I spent most of my career at Paramount, and you guys came back to Paramount when at Cheers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you were there from that point on.
Yeah, we were there for about 20 years, yeah.
Yeah. So, and we were lucky that, I mean, when I first was there, and when you first were there, we had John Pike and John Sines as the executives. Who did we agree with everything they said? I'm sure we didn't, but they were always good guys who helped you get things done. And later in our career, we had McCluggage and Gary Hart. Did we agree with everything? And did they agree with us all the time? No. But boy, you could always get Gary Hart on the phone to help you solve a problem. And I've heard stories from people at other lots where it was such an antagonistic relationship with the studio or with the network. And, we didn't have that. So that made the job a little easier, don't you think?
Absolutely. I think in many ways, like MTM in the 70s was Camelot. You know, you had great writers and you had Grant Tinker and it was really a wonderful experience. And I think Camelot 2.0 was Paramount in the 80s and 90s. You had, again, terrific management. You had really good shows. And it was kind of like a college. And we all knew each other from all the different shows. And, you know, how late was your rewrite night? And I heard your show went through the roof last Tuesday night, that type of thing. And, you know, we shared crews among the shows, and we consulted on each other's shows. And if one of us had a pilot, the others worked on it. When we did Almost Perfect and you weren't on a show, you consulted for us, and we consulted for you. And yeah, it really was kind of like Camelot.
I mean, that's when you said before, and I always try to correct people, you said, well, you know, I know you, you worked on Frasier for a number of years, and you go, well, yes, I was a consultant on Frasier, but if there was ever a show that didn't need any help, let alone my help, it was Frasier. By the time I got there in the week, those shows were so tight and so well done, and the hard work had already been done, that I sat there going, well, you know, we would be talking about future stories, but I'm happy to have it on my resume, but believe me, I did so little on that show. I was just proud to be in the neighborhood. You know?
Yeah, I think it's very important to have a guy come in like on Friday and go, it works.
Yeah.
That's very important job.
Did you ever work with Ellison and Lloyd where, and I started, as I said, I worked with them on Dear John and on Wings, and then Bob was with us on Becker. But when they were working on the same show, they each did a different night.
Right.
And so David would do the reading day. And sometimes we'd have to, for Ed Weinberger, we'd have to rewrite the entire show after the reading. And if there came a really tough spot after David dictated most of the script off the top of his head, there would be a tough blow or something. He'd go, that's SFE. Let's keep going. And I finally figured out that meant save for Ellison. Mm-hmm. And then Bob would come in the next day and we'd be working on a show for the next week. He'd go, oh, that's definitely SFL. Let's keep going. That's saved for Lloyd. And I always figured that you and David, I don't know, we didn't call it SFL and SFI, but I think you two probably.
We did the same thing.
Your codes between.
We did the same thing because I was there the day before David. Yeah. And we would hit a rough spot, and I would say, you know, there's a guy. This kind of joke is right in his wheelhouse. Save this for David. We could take a half an hour and do it now, or David will come up with it in 3 minutes. So just leave it for David, you know. And then he would come in 2 days later and go, what the fuck? This is my partner, ladies and gentlemen, throwing me under the bus. Yeah.
Whatever happened to those two?
I don't know. They're doing podcasts. Anyway, it was a great time. It was great working with you. And, you know, there are a lot of people still who love Wings, who love Becker, and two shows that I'm extremely proud to be a part of. And thanks to you for letting me be a part of it. Okay, there you go. I don't have any parting gifts.
Well, I still have a couple blows left over from Almost Perfect. I'll send them to you.
Okay, great. I'll use them.
Thanks, Ken. This was fun.
And there you go, our two-parter with Dave Hackel. If you want to get in touch with me for any reason, my email address is HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. That's HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. I'm on Twitter, @KenLevine. I'm on Instagram, Hollywood and Levine. Our thanks, as always, to Adam and Susie Meister-Butler, to Howard Hoffman, John Wolfert, Bruce and Jason Miller. Thank you for listening. Back again next week, right here on
Hollywood and Levine.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.